Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi Nick, are you bored of drinking big fat shots of director's bitter and ladyboy chasers at home?
Tom, I ruddy bloody am. I'm hopping mad and just want some exciting craft beers to enjoy when I'm watching my Bond videos. That's not too much to ask, is it?
Well, have I got some good news for you. The fantastic chaps at Beer 52 have given us a special offer they'd like us to share with our listeners.
Can I just shock you? I like special offers. Do tell me more.
All you need to do is go to beer52.com/monkeytennis, cover the postage cost of £5.95, and you'll be sent a box of 8 cracking craft beers, plus a magazine, and 2 beer-appropriate snacks.
Wow, that is a real breath of fresh air. So you're telling me to get a free case of 8 unique craft beers from Beer 52, I just need to go to beer52.com/monkeytennis and cover the postage costs of £5.95?
Yep, it's literally that simple. It really is lovely stuff.
Oh, sometimes you want to say, sod all this wine, just give me 8 craft beers.
And I've really got to say this, Nick, Beer 52 is the world's largest beer club.
Mmm.
Yep, each month members are sent a case with a different theme. Past themes have included Belgium, Korea, California, New Zealand and many more.
But what if I don't like dark beers?
They've got that covered too. If you don't like dark beer, you can choose a light beer option. And you can pause or cancel at any time. Simply go to beer52.com/monkeytennis and just pay £5.95 postage to get all this now.
Crash, bang, wallop, what an offer. 8 free beers, a magazine and 2 snacks for less than £6 postage. Mine's not a pint, mine's a box of 8 craft beers. I'll drink to that.
I am hopping mad and I want something in the middle.
Aha!
Yep, absolutely. Yep, absolutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dan!
Monkey tennis?
Little pierce my foot on a spike.
With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
No.
Monkey tennis?
Radical. Awesome. Mega.
Monkey tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Edmonds is a total wazzup of a guy.
Yes, 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 and yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that?
Like, this is great banter.
Yeah. Back of the net.
Monkey tennis?
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Hello and welcome to Monkey Tennis episode 129. This week, myself, Adam Brooks, and Tom Dark are in the interviewer's chairs. But before we set the chat amongst the pigeons with our guest, here's a quick reminder of how you can get in touch with us and, if you like, how you can support the show. So you can email us, thepartridgepod@gmail.com, on facebook.com, it's /thepartridgepod, on Twitter, we're @thepartridgepod, Instagram, it's at Monkey Tennis Pod. Every now and then, somebody leaves us a voice note on the Monkey Tennis Hotline and we'll put it in an episode. That's 07923 600 017. And if you are enjoying what you hear, for free, I might add, at this festive giving time of year, why not drop us the price of a cup of coffee to show your appreciation at ko-fi.com/monkeytennis.
Thanks, Adam. Today, we are joined by a very special guest indeed. Having recently departed the BBC gravy train after 14 glorious years of dour and self-deprecating breakfasts and afternoons on Six Music, today's guest is now finally giving the world of podcasting a warm and loving embrace with his new podcast shows, The Lineup and Rockanori. But more importantly than that, we finally pinned him down to chat about Alan Gordon Partridge, the only broadcaster we hold in higher regard than him. Yes, ladies and gents, that's right, it's only ruddy bloody Sean Keaveney.
Yay!
Yay!
Yeah. Try to go
wild. Hang on, let me just open this bottle of Prosecco to celebrate. There we go.
Oh, look at that. That's a Partridge-esque bit of Foley there.
Ooh,
wonderful.
Isn't it?
So, thanks so much for joining us, Sean. Let's start at the beginning, Alan-wise. Can you recall when you first encountered Alan, what your earliest memories were, at what point in the Partridge universe you jumped on the Partridge gravy train?
Well, it would have been, I don't think I was an early enough adopter to have caught the On the Hour, I think it was called originally, wasn't it, became the day to day on BBC television. But I think that me and my northern mates, we've always been devotees of poured over various different parts of the comedy, you know, sort of spectrum. And so I think we got on to the day-to-day quite quickly. And I guess it was there, really, you know, all that sort of fantastic early Alan as shot through the Chris Morris prism, you know, all that, eat my goal, the goalkeeper has football pie all over his jersey, you know, all that. I think that was our entry point. Twat! all that stuff, you know, the 1994 World Cup. So yeah, that was probably the when we got on the train.
Would you say that that's remained your favourite Alan, the sort of slightly more surreal, the Alan by committee a little bit, or do you think as he's developed and they've kind of rooted him more into reality that you prefer some of the stuff that's come since?
Oh God, I think it's impossible to say. It's like, for me, the more sort of interviews that I do, and I'm on the sort of, you know, the business end, as it were, as opposed to asking the questions, the more I realise how much I repeat myself and end up talking about the same themes all the time over and over again. So I always, at least once an interview, I talk about the Beatles. Maybe once every three interviews, I'll talk about one of the members of Led Zeppelin. You know, it's like we've got this small gene pool, sort of culturally. But it's a bit, or it's a bit like your favourite children, I think, with something like Partridge. Coogan and the teams around him have done so much unbelievably brilliant work since then, since the start of the 90s till now. It's just a matter of what you feel like at that particular time, you know. I do love surreal early Chris Morris Alan. I love that sort of bouncing back era Alan very much, the Travel Tavern Alan, because it, and that North Norfolk digital stuff, because a lot of it's sort of the older I get, the more I realise that I am a sort of like a real life IRL version of Alan in a lot of ways. And that is almost a joke, but not a joke at the same time. You know, just looking back on things like seeing Alan, should I say, Steve and Chris Morris do that interview about, you know, when he upset the farmers, and hearing all that sort of flowery Chris Morris language come back into Alan's universe again is fantastic. You know, the sort of spinal column on a BAP, you know, he gets the cow dropped on him. So I love all that surreal stuff, but I do love it, every iteration, because it's like watching somebody's life, and I love what they've done with him. He's so woven into our lives that he's. I worry about Steve Coogan genuinely. I was talking to Nina Conti about this last week. I did an interview with her, the phenomenal ventriloquist and comedian, and we were talking about the psychology of what it's like to do her job, and how these characters are versions of, or levels of, her own personality. And I was just postulating how difficult it is going to be at some point in the future if Steve ever decides to kill off Alan. It's like Alan is so much of a person now that there would be a genuine bereavement. And not just for Steve Coogan, I think for all of us, we'd all be like, what the... Alan's died. I probably need to take... I mean, I'm taking probably about a year off work at the moment by accident, but I probably would have to just like lie under a duvet for a month if Alan died. So... very long and pointless answer to the question. There is no favourite part of that whole universe. It's just I love living in it.
That's fair. I mean, and it's interesting to your point about that he is basically a fully formed person, that, you know, there's an archivist somewhere that's written up his timeline, and obviously there's an autobiography that covers more or less every inch of everything he's ever done. And also, if they ever do decide to can it, it will feel, you know, in some senses, it will feel a bit like a genuine bereavement, but it'll also feel a bit like a murder because someone's got to decide to do it at some point as well.
That's true.
You know, it's going to feel like a selfish act, I think, when we see Steve pull the plug on something that everybody loves so much.
I wonder if he's thought about it. I don't know if you guys have talked to him, but, you know, I wonder if he has in his head that he wouldn't tell anybody a sort of, either he dies with me, you know, he dies when I die, or if he thinks... if I make it to 70, that's when I'm throwing him in the grave, you know.
Yeah, like a Partridge Endgame, if you will. I mean, knowing what we do know of Steve, I would say I think the latter part's definitely true. I can't imagine him wanting to hand the reins over of the property to anyone
that's
else.
True.
I think he's very protective of Bran Partridge. But yeah, whether he's got an idea in mind of, you know, this is how he's going to die and this is when it's going to happen, I don't know.
It's really interesting. I wonder whether Steve or any of Steve and the writing team have ever considered killing him off, because, you know, you could imagine maybe, I don't know, late 90s, early 2000s, they might have toyed with that idea possibly. But I think, you know, on reflection now, they'd be very pleased that they haven't. Because you look at, like, there's been so much more Partridge that has happened post I'm Alan Partridge that perhaps people would never have expected.
Do you know what I think would be poetic? And I hope this isn't making light of a dark situation, but for him to take a leaf out of Bowie's book and to have the death of Partridge recorded and locked in for release when Steve himself goes.
I bet he's... I know you've said it. I bet that's what he's done. It's like, you're right though. It's like the rich stuff that's come recently, you know. I got COVID for Christmas last year, right? That's what I
got
for Christmas. Yeah. 22nd of December. 23rd of December, you've got COVID. 24th of December, I lost my taste and smell. The only reason I mention this, apart from the fact that I always mention it because I'm always looking for sympathy, is that one of the things that got me through it was the Beastie Boys documentary, listening to Ill Communication for some reason, but also Alan Partridge from the Oast House, you know, the Audible series.
And I
did think, as somebody who's toyed with radio comedy in some ways, in different iterations myself, the level of production on that and the quality of it and the depth, and I know that I'm preaching to the inquiry here big time, innit? But the depth of character in it, it's just breathtaking, really. I'm just like, God, like you say, Tom, it's like, I bet they thank the lucky, the God that they never knocked it on the head back in the day, because he can react to everything, can't he? It's like on this time, he's all that post Me Too Alan trying to fit in, like a, you know, like a sort of into modern society and failing utterly and miserably. He's just so much comedy gold. But then I do also think that it's weird to watch, as long as Richard Madeley is still with us, how I said that maybe I'm a bit Alan. Richard Madeley is Alan Partridge for real, isn't he? But like 18 times stronger.
And it's at the point now where their paths have crossed in so many ways. It's hard to know who's playing off who at some points.
It's like, I know Jeremy Vine, of course, because I used to use him a lot on my show and we're friends. So I think you wouldn't mind me saying this, but he's another one who I think has identified, oh, I do sound a little bit like parody-ish sometimes when I'm saying things, don't I? I think I'll transgress that line. And no, I haven't got a fucking clue anymore when he's taking the piss out of us or when he's doing it without thinking, you know. It's just like, it's the Partridge thing has infected us all.
Well, it feels like early Doors, the Noel Edmonds and the Bill Oddies of this world that were getting referenced on Partridge, you know, were very careful to distance themselves. But now it feels like it's such an institution, it's been around for 30 years. People who are a bit Partridge are actively leaning into it.
Yeah, leaning into Partridge.
Do you think someone like Richard Madeley knows what he's doing in that respect, though? I do, because he seems like such a kind of... I don't know. I just feel like he literally, you never know what he's going to say next when he's broadcasting. I wonder whether it's calculated or he's just that much of a kind of madcap entity.
I think I wouldn't be surprised if, and again, you people who are devotees of this will know better than me, but if Steve Coogan fed a bit of Madeley into the front, into Partridge anyway, so it's that way around. But yeah, I think Richard Madeley is Judy and I, making love, and we like to listen to the Beastie Boys, and sometimes I give it something to bite down on, and that's just the way we do it, you know, and it's fantastic. Anyway, coming up after the break, Gina DeCampo is going to show us how to make churros. You know, it's that was already there, so I'm pretty sure that he's been fed into Alan, but no, it's like a fucking human centipede, and Richard Madeley has consumed so much Alan Partridge, he doesn't know who he is anymore.
I think that's a really interesting point. There's definitely a kind of a self-fulfilling nature of the character in terms of, I guess, in the very early TV iterations, something like Knowing Me, Knowing You, I think that very much lent into things like Wogan and stuff like that. So you do kind of go with the perhaps the key broadcasting kind of qualities of the day, I guess. So yeah, that does kind of make sense that it isn't just broadcasters being, I'm going to copy that. It's also Coogan and the writing team going, this is what's happening in the world of broadcasting these days. This is what we need to bring into it. Yeah, well, that makes a lot of sense.
It's the same in my game, you know, in radio broadcasting. It's the same thing could be said of Smashy and Nicey in the early 90s, you know, sort of White House and Enfield creating those characters that were so... not perfect DLTs, Tony Blackburns, etc. And of course, to the extent that they took parts of those people's, the things that they'd done and sort of lampooned them. And it's very difficult then to remember which one happened on the TV show and which one happened in real life. They've mixed it all together so perfectly. And now, 20, 30 years along the line, especially if you listen to Radio 2 a lot of the time, it's like culture has digested Smashy and Nicey. And these DJs and presenters have, not all of them, some of them, who shall remain nameless. And it's almost like they're doing Smashy and Nicey themselves, but in a post-ironic way. It's very confusing to know where real life begins and where fantasy starts. But then that's my whole life's confused like that. That's why I'm sitting here dressed as a fucking unicorn.
We thought that was just for us.
No.
I mean, having failed to tie you down on a favourite Alan moment, episode, etc., are there quotes and lines that immediately come to mind when you think of Alan? Have you woven some into your shows, into radio over the years? Like, what are the go-to to Alanisms for you?
Oh, there's so much. I mean, for a start, we had a thing called a cartwheel at the radio, which contained... I don't know, 7,000 or 8,000 different sound clips, beds and things. And there was a partial wall that was Alan, you know. Dan, 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 kiss my face, lady boys, you know. So I would weave those in occasionally whenever somebody called Dan texted, of course. They'd get a three Dans. But there's just so much to go at with that. It's like, where does one begin? Kiss my face. You know, any... As far as episodic things are concerned and characters, like, I noticed that you did an interview 2 or 3 years ago with Simon, didn't you? With Michael.
Yeah.
Yes.
Forgive me, I forgot the actor.
Simon Greenall.
Simon Greenall, one of the great character actors of any generation, you know. And that relationship, any episode with that relationship in it, it just blows me away because, again, it's just so, you know, it's Alan the... as a child, isn't it, be at the feet of this ex-SAS man with an impenetrable accent and, you know, just trying to impress each other, the cuppa suit moment, you know. There's just, you know, those moments like, book me now or wait for Cliff Thorburn.
thank you very much. You know, all that kind of the whole bouncing back stuff. That you know, a man on his uppers. I've stood on a spike. I watched that again the other day because it's one of the great gifts of doing this podcast with you wonderful guys is that you get an excuse. I'm working, love. I'm working. Yeah, I'm watching 2 hours of Alan Partridge. Yeah. It's for a work thing. No, I can't put the kids to bed. You know, it was like that.
Happy to help. Thank you
very much. And but that whole bit where Alan is at the golf club and he's about to pass out because he stood on the spike and he's being sick and he's setting off the gyros and stuff. Some of these people have come from Stoklin. You know, all that. Oh, it was a good year. You know, the desperation, that kind of, have I got a second series? It's all woven. It's like watching my own life a lot of the time. And I guess that's probably what I'm talking about, you know. There's so much recognition in there for me. But then what's interesting, I'm a sort of lower, middle-ranking media person. But for everybody else who loves it who isn't, it's the greater truth, isn't it? It's this guy who thinks he's better than he is, who's unbelievably flawed, but who's kind of likable as well. It's the classic sitcom, British sitcom sort of setup, isn't it? It's, you know, somebody like John Cleese. You can see the lineage of it, and it's all like Harry H. Corbett in Steptoe and Son. That whole thwarted man who should be better than he is thing, you know. I just think it's so universal and beautiful, but nobody does it better. And that's why we've got whole podcasts dedicated to it, and people happy to go, I'll talk for an hour about that because I fucking love it. But yeah, you know, all that's like when he talks about that episode, I've gone into the sort of 97 era a bit here, but the Stephen Mangan episode, Dan, he's the titular Dan, isn't he? Mm, that whole bromance. And, you know, when he's talking about that program he's got on whatever, the distant satellite chat, Skirmish it's called, Skirmish, or something, isn't it? You know, that whole thing of, I mean, I literally am writing a memoir as we speak. I literally am. So that is my bouncing back, I guess, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's like there's no distance left to run here between me and Alan in many ways. And if there was a North Norfolk Digital, I'd be going for a fucking job on it.
But there is a North Norfolk Digital now. That is now a real thing.
Oh, I didn't know that.
No, and so I like to think, because they could have called it anything. So I like to think that is art becoming life. That's Partridge influence. God. Someone's picked that because of Alan, I think. I also like to imagine, Sean, that there's points where you're writing your memoir and you're thinking, oh, this is getting a bit too bouncing back. And then other points where you're thinking, oh, I could make this a bit bouncing back.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. Well, that's exactly right. You don't know when you're... I've done loads of stuff on the radio over the years where I have... And I would like to think... I've been doing radio shows for 20 years and I've always had a sort of... a style, I suppose, by accident. And after about 12 or 13 years, you go, oh, that's my style, isn't it? You know, when you start and the first 3 or 4 bosses that you have say, you know, it was great, it was a really good show, but could you just put a bit more energy into it, maybe? Or, you know, just like your voice sounds a little bit like you're bored, you know? And for the first few years, you think, oh, fucking hell, I've got to sound a bit chirpier. And then you realize, no, that's my fucking style, you know? But like, but equally, like some of the features that you might do or some of the text throwouts that you might do, they're so, I don't know. It's a bit like what we were talking about earlier. I no longer know whether it's just I love the minutiae of life, you know, like, okay, 64046, how much change is in your pocket? You know, that's the text of today. And you can get an hour out of that on the radio if you do it right. But I don't know how much of that is influenced by him in the first place, or whether it's just that me and Alan have got similar tastes. It's
difficult. I think a lot of particularly kind of like radio broadcasters that are big Alan fans definitely feel like it's like we spoke to John Robbins a few weeks ago. And I think it's definitely a thing when you're getting into the phone-ins and the text-in topics, that's always feels like that's the bit that tips over it most into real-life Partridge, because it is about the mundane aspects of life that kind of where those interactions with the public always work best, but that's also where Partridge's kind of broadcast persona lies as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, you know, what I do think, and again, to name absolutely no names, but I do think there are broadcasters out there who have a similar, you know, often with Alan, there's a little disdain for some of the people that are coming on the line. You know, he's obviously a massive snob, isn't he? Essentially, and that will come through sometimes. Oh, you know, and there are people who, some people who are a bit like that. You just get the feeling that these, if it weren't for the bloody listeners, they'd enjoy the job, you know.
I wanted to ask if you're writing a memoir at the moment, have you read or listened to the Partridge books, I, Partridge and Nomad?
Amazingly, I haven't. No, I'm saving those for the next time I get COVID or I break my pelvis.
Yep,
it's like Game of Thrones. You know, I've got no interest in watching it or at all. However, if I do shatter my pelvis in a painting and decorating accident, I've got it all to go. So, but yeah, I've not. I mean, that's why my brother should be on this, Paul, because he's even more into. He's a bit more encyclopedic than I am. I'm a generalist, and he's a bit more specialist. And he's like he will have listened to all of those. And would have ready quotes, but that's why he cajoled me to listen to the Oast House, and I did love that one. What are those ones like then?
I think if you've loved the Oast House, I think you would absolutely love the books, and I think probably collectively on the podcast, we would always champion the audiobook version above the printed version, just because you're getting Coogan doing it in Alan's voice.
I'd also say that the quality bar is set quite high, in that I think everyone's expectations around a fictional character's book are fairly low. And often, you know, there's lots of, let's say, lesser characters or lesser comedy vehicles over the years where the book is very clearly a cash-in, whereas these books really do feel like they exist on their own. It's a labour of love. They could have been much more straightforward, much more like heavily leaning on the I, Man and Partridge material or years, you know, but they've made something that stands upon its own, I think.
Yeah, I think the two books are, I think, are both quality additions to the kind of the world or the Alan Partridge universe, as we call it. They're not just, you know, they could definitely be, we've all seen these sort of TV cash-in books that are essentially could just be a few scripts and a load of glossy photos and maybe some fictionalised letters or something.
Yeah.
And that's all it ever is, but they properly add to the character, and I think the reason why they work so well is because you're getting Alan's narration, and Alan is an unreliable narrator, so you're getting his version of these events that we've seen play out in Know Me, Knowing You, in I'm Alan Partridge, in Mid-Morning Matters. So getting the character's take on it is where the comedy lies, you're like, well, we know that that's actually not what happened, or that's actually not what that other character was thinking. I think particularly I, Partridge as the audiobook is one of my favourite pieces of Partridge, probably. I'd really put it up there. If you love Oast House, there's no way you won't love those, I would say. But however, it might be worth avoiding until you've written your memoir, because they might become too influential. I don't know.
I honestly do agree. I think that because I do tend to do that. I soak it up like eggy bread sometimes. You know, you spend a bit too much time. Like, I did notice a few months ago, my two elder boys, I got them into This Country.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, Kerry and Kurt and Mucklow. And we all got submerged into that universe with my wife and stuff. And we boshed all the series pretty quickly, because that's what kids do these days, of course, isn't it? Doof, 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 doof. I watched them all, Dad. You've only, fucking hell. I only saw you yesterday. But I did notice that I started to, when I was on air, I started sort of talking a bit like them. You know, that kind of way, not in a West Country accent, but the same
kind of rhythm.
Rhythm and stuff. Yeah. And it's like, so you're right, I've got to be careful when I, because, you know, when people pore over this tome in years to come, after I'm dead, you know, the Sean Keamy's autobiography, and it becomes another central, I don't think it's going to get taught in schools or not, you know, but it's going to be probably one of those influential texts. I don't want them to think, oh, it sounded like he was listening to Alan Partridge when he wrote.
Because also what I really enjoyed learning was that the Gibbons brothers and Coogan, they used, so Tony Blackburn has a memoir called Poptastic. I don't know if you've heard of that, but they use that as quite an influential piece upon their writing of I, Partridge. So I think they've taken quite a lot of ideas from that, but obviously made them more Alan. So basically taking the Tony Blackburn out and put the Alan Blackburn in, and it definitely works.
It's and again, Tony, who is one of the absolute peerless greats, and I do know very, very slightly. In fact, I did a Children in Need stand-up competition with him in 2012. And he was very, very funny. Funnier even than Jenny Murray, I would say. But he's another one. You're right. He's a rich text because, again, Smashy and Nicey took some of his life wholesale, didn't they? Like when he split up from the actor lady, Tessa, I forgot her surname, and then he would play the same song every day on his radio show and say, you know, come back to me, which is pathos, is Shakespearean in its depth of tragedy. But no, tragedy plus time equals comedy, doesn't it? So thank you again, Tony. And Tony's got the last laugh because he's got two shows a week on Radio 2 still, even though he's 80, you know. He's still
And I think he's very aware that he has influenced Smashy and Nicey and Alan Partridge and kind of doesn't really shy away. I feel like he doesn't really shy away from it. I feel like he hasn't really modified what he does or how he broadcasts. He's like, well, this is who I am, and if this is what creates this rich comedy, then so be it. And I think the thing about him playing the song for his ex, I feel like that sort of stuff seeps into Mid Morning Matters as well. I think with Alan breaking up with Angela and stuff like that, they're definitely referencing those kind of things that have happened as well.
I love that in the Arse Toast, if I remember rightly. I didn't have a temperature at the time, but he goes on a date, doesn't he, which plays out over a few episodes, and it's all quite hopeful at the beginning, and of course being Alan, he completely fucks it up. But again, you feel for him, don't you, at the same time as laughing loudly at him.
I feel like we'd probably agree that over the years, we've actually all become more sympathetic towards him as a character. I think in the early iterations, you're like, well, I don't think he's ever an arsehole per se, but he's a bit of an idiot and sometimes has not the nicest streak. And I think he's mellowed as a character over the 30 years, and you do now have sympathy for him when it comes to his relationships and kind of how he interacts with the opposite sex, which is, I think, more fleshed out than in the early days. It was basically him and Lynn and his broken relationship with Carol, and that was all you'd ever have to kind of get into.
The chocolate mousse as well, of course.
Well, and Jill, of course. Lovely Jill.
By the time you get to this time, he's often the person in the conversation that you're rooting for as well. Yeah. I don't think that never used to be true.
That's true. Yeah,
He's up against some bigger pricks in this time than he ever was before.
Absolutely. Is it Simon Farnaby who plays?
The brilliant Simon Farnaby.
He's so funny. He's so brilliant. He's so great at that kind of character as well. The sort of, a lad in a smoothie kind of git.
He's got that kind of. He carries that inherent smugness across from Detectorists as well. He's not a dissimilar character there. Yeah.
The son of the head of factual programming. So, Sean, we were keen to just delve into your radio career a little bit to develop this kind of IRL, this real-life Partridge element. So if you could tell us a bit about perhaps your very early days, your beginnings. I'm all right that you began with local radio before you went on to XFM.
Well, no, I didn't actually. No? Well, no, you're right. You are right. But what it was, that's why, again, especially that Travel Tavern era of Alan is very interesting for me because I think that was around 97 that came out.
Yes, yeah.
If I'm right. And at that time, I'd been drifting for a good couple of years. My mother was despairing of me because I'd finished my shite degree, living at home, doing terrible. I was a Citizens Advice Bureau advisor for 9 months, which, if anybody knows me, just the most ill, the worst choice in the world, sort of scatty moron when it comes to, where's that file gone? I've left it on the bus, And then I was one of those sort of catalogue advisors who would sell teal sweaters to the elderly. I did that. I quite enjoyed that, actually. And then I got a job writing radio ads for GWR Group, they were called.
I remember GWR, yeah.
You remember, yeah. So these
share my age as well there, yeah.
But, you know, now it would be like the Magic Group or Greatest Hits or whatever, but it was GWR then. And so it was 210 FM's Better Music Mix for Berkshire and Basingstoke. Started there, and then I moved up to Wolverhampton. So when that era of Alan was out, I was working in local radio, but I wasn't behind the mic yet. And so I got to absorb all of that entire world. I watched it. In fact, I've never told him this, even though I'm a mate of Steve Wright in the afternoon now. But I remember that it was in an old farmhouse, our office, the creatives office at 210 FM. And we were in the sort of eaves of this old fire station. And it was it was an odd thing. You look down and you could see like the news people and all this. And there was a big kerfuffle one day. And it was like a dignitary had arrived and we didn't know what the fuck was going on. And we were craning our necks and it was Steve Wright. Steve Wright arrived because I think he used to do a show at 210 FM, you know, like what it would have been 20 years before. And he was lit. It was like Kim and Kanye had turned up, you know. Everybody was, understandably, they were like in local radio especially, it's like you're a godhead. And he was sort of like, oh, hello friends, yes, and this is where, of course, yes, I remember we used to have breakfast in here, you know, and all that. But it was just like, it was a real masterclass in watching what local radio is and what it's like and who it appeals to. Because I used to be a copywriter, I used to ride shotgun with all the salespeople. And I still remember them all so well. They were all, to a man or a woman, gorgeous people, but like really of a type, you know. And you would go out, you'd be driven out to everywhere from local pine factories to Jeff's Butchers, just off the A34. We lived in that world, you know. And I remember I did my first taste of local radio fame was there was a DJ called Neil James. And he, for some reason, must have liked the cut of my jib. And he said, would you come on my show on Thursday afternoon and just like invent a character?
Oh, hang on. Is this basically to be like Sidekick Sean?
I guess. You know, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah. But yeah, he would have been my Alan and I would have been his Simon. I would have been his Tim Key. And I said, sure, yeah, because I love writing a bit of comedy and that, you know. And he said, just pretend that you're, what I'm going to say is that you're a local guy who's won the lottery. And that was the premise. And I went in, I've only just remembered this. And I went in and I was like, yeah, and we're going to be talking to Lloyd Allen. Next, you so the lottery. Tell us a bit about it, and I made up this story about how I've got a wooden leg, and I used to receive vibrations in it, and that's where I got the numbers from. And we just sort of confected this entire character on the spot, and it was just very odd, but it was also, you know, just so great to be with these DJs because they were so. Some of these guys were very Alan, you know. You'd have Graham Torrington doing Late Night Love.
I remember him.
Do you remember?
That must have been a syndicated show.
Torrington was syndicated, he was. Yeah. And you could tell Graham was syndicated because he used to drive a top-of-the-range BMW from Sintner's
the real
BMW.
Money. Yeah.
You know, and then it was like Guy and Harriet on BBC, on Breakfast. And Guy, I'll never forget, it was 1997, and he just got a brand-new 97 plate VW Golf, and I was so fucking jealous of it, you know. And I also used to watch all how the sort of better performing sales people got slightly better Peugeot 306s than the ones who weren't doing as well. And the ones that weren't doing as well were Adrian Olney, who was the sales director, who used to really be on him, and like, you know, he was a bit like a sort of a pound shop Al Pacino, you know. You want the 306 with the automatic gear change? You better bring in that fucking account. You know, and it was all that whole, it was very important what badge your car was and which dealership it came from and all that. That entire world was Alan world. And so that was my introduction to it for reals, you know.
That's some of the stuff I find so fascinating about Alan is the sort of the kind of the side hustles of people working in radio as well, like just the relationship between people, you know, opening things, supermarkets, yeah, fairs, you know, kind of, and the kind of the relationship with like local car dealers and sort of businesses in the area, and like obviously the Dante Fire corporate, you know, the kind of the sidestep into well paid but often quite crushing corporate stuff as well. Like I feel like that's something that never really got televised before. I saw Alan doing a lot of it.
It was beautiful how they did it, and it was so true they did it, and it just, again, it speaks to that larger, the larger dilemmas of life, especially like, it's, you know, are you comfortable being a big fish in a small pond? That's I think what's a lot of it comes down to that, actually. That's the big question. Are you comfortable being a big fish in a small pond? No, is the answer for most people, because you can do it. You can do it for 3 or 4 years, and then you start getting ideas bigger than your station, and that's Alan, isn't it? That's, it's almost like that. I remember the guy who wrote Breaking Bad, boiling Breaking Bad down to Mr. Chips becomes Scarface. It's the same iteration. It's like, when do you get too big for your boots, and what happens to you? And it's like, because I thought this a million times. I remember, I've got it written down in some fucking diary somewhere, like 2002, when I'd been doing my early morning ball breaking early breakfast show for a couple of years by then on London's 104.9 XFM, 3 till 6:30 a.m. And that is one thankless motherfucking time of the day to be doing anything, because you end up becoming a carer mostly for the people who are listening. You've got the lonely people and the, you know, the people who've just broken up with the boyfriends and girlfriends, and then you've got your people who are on medication, and that's basically a lot of your audience, you know. And that's not a piss take. That's like, you have a duty of care to a lot of these people, you know.
I've not done this to anywhere near the extent you did, but I very briefly did a stint on overnights at Red Dragon, that's now Capital South Wales, and had that exact thing.
Yeah, really?
You know, very much you without, not even a producer there.
Yeah,
either.
Not
you
producer, know, just you. You in the building sometimes.
It's a can of Little Red Bull. It's 14 disturbed callers.
Yeah.
It's the first copy of The Next Day's Sun and 5 hours to fill.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
My first ever gig was midnight to 6 a.m. on Sunday into Monday morning. 6 hours of live radio with about 140 listeners. You try, I mean, that is the full 5 loaves and 3 fishes, mate, I'm telling you. But but this is a great, but I wrote it down somewhere in a diary, which was like, look, Sean, you know, you've got to look at your life choices. You've left the north, you've left your hearth and home, all your friends and family are up there. I was traveling up every 3 or 4 weeks because I missed everybody that much. Just try and get a job at Key 103. Just try and get a job on BBC Manchester. You know, why are you trying to crack London? Why are you trying to... Sorry, that was Barack Obama again. Why are you trying to crack the national stations? Just know your level. And that is still a question for me now. You know, having popped out of national radio, it's like, just to make it about me for a minute, and looking at the landscape, I've said this to my wife, I've said this to my loved ones. I've been like, I still want to do live radio, but I don't know where I can do it anymore. So maybe I'll just do a few other things, like a few side hustles, couple of podcasts, bit of voiceover, and maybe, I don't know, just like move to the coast and get like a drive time slot on Ocean FM or something, and be that big fish in that small pond, and open those supermarkets and get that free, what would it be now? It wouldn't be a Lexus now. It wouldn't be a Rover. It would be not a Prius. It would be the Gullwing Tesla. You know, get one of those. I might have to have the dealership's name emblazoned on the side of it, but it'd be worth it to get the free Tesla and to be treated. And every time I go to Ruhit's Indian restaurant, I get a free meal.
Yeah, you know, can have it emblazoned down the side. Sean Keaveney drives this Tesla.
Yeah. And it's like, what is actually wrong with that? Nothing. So, but for Alan, it was never, you know, he got a taste of national stardom, didn't he? And then he was like, well, I could be as big as Eamon Holmes. Why am I not as big as Eamon Holmes? I'm more talented than him.
And over 30 years, they've had the opportunity for Alan to sort of bob up to the surface and then back down again, you know, like Mid-Morning Matters. Yeah. He's relatively comfortable on North Norfolk Digital. You know, he's fairly settled. But then the prospect of this time and being back on the BBC comes back. And so they've been able to sort of have him go through that wave a couple of times.
We're not. None of us are immune to it at all. It doesn't matter what job you're in or how you make your living. We're all. It's that little taste of what could be And oh, you know, and that plumping of the ego pillows, isn't it? We all enjoy.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
It's interesting because we were going to ask how accurate does the Alan we see in the radio studio feel, but I think we've very much covered that by all of this conversation, because everything that you've just talked about are things that are scripted and displayed. You know, it's whether it is going to the country fair and judging the marrow competition or it is like the Disturbed Callers. So it's amazing to see they've got it so right. They've got all of those details of local radio life so correct.
It's like, and obviously we must mention on that tip, Phil Cornwell, isn't it? Who plays, I can't remember the name of the
Dave
character.
Clifton.
Dave Clifton.
This right. is what I think this is what I was going to ask you next.
Go on.
Well, I was going to ask, did
is
you
there
ever
a Dave Clifton
have
in
you,
my life?
Yeah, did you or have you ever had a Dave Clifton style nemesis? 100%.
Yeah.
This is the big question, Sean. Let's go.
Is this one? Is this the one that's going to go viral? And of all our lovely chat, it's this one. And then 10 o'clock news tonight.
Yeah, this is a clip. Let's go.
Well, yeah, I mean, to contextualise it, I genuinely believe it's like that episode of The Simpsons where, you know, that everybody has a nemesis episode, and it's even Maggie's got a nemesis, which is the baby across the road, and they're sort of sucking the dummies at each other. It's like, it's just part of life, isn't it? And I think that you would agree, Tom, having known me for some years, and I'm not putting tabs on myself here, it's an affliction as much as anything else. I am one of the most easygoing, nice, easy to get on with people in the fucking world, right? To my immense detriment a lot of the time. I've got no boundaries.
I'll agree. And you haven't paid me to say that, just to clarify for the listeners.
Yet. I'm not saying it as a kind of good thing. It's like I live to please other people to the colossal detriment of my own psychology. And I will end up going absolutely apeshit at some point in a supermarket, you know. But until that time, I've got a lot of goodwill in the bank. However, there are always people that Dave Clifton knew. There are people in all of our lives who make us feel less than. There are people in all of our lives who don't even probably know they're doing it sometimes. It's just the dynamic that you've set up. It could be in the family. It could be amongst your friendship group. It could be the people you work with. There might be one person who's your Achilles heel who just walks into the room and they deflate you. And they may, and it's not even their fault a lot of the time. It's just, it might be some preconception you've got. And to I'm going about the bushes here, that there definitely have been people in my broadcasting life who have, like, oh, you know, I've got, oh, God. Like, it would have been people like, and I never used to like handing over a lot of the time to Christian O'Connell, because he was so successful and so brilliant, and he was, you know, clanking around with, I think he ended up with, he's gone off to Melbourne now, but I think before he left these shows, he had something like 24 Sony Awards or something. Now, I've got, hang on, I haven't got any. And we the nearest we got as a breakfast show back in the day was, we came four, I always tell this, it's not a joke, but it's a funny thing to say. We got nominated for Best Breakfast Show in 2009, and we got all dressed up and we got dead excited and we're like, this is finally happening. And this is 12 years ago, right? And of course, they do gold, silver and bronze, and we were none of those. So we were like, well, we were fourth or fifth that year, and that's as good as that. Like, get that on a t-shirt. You know, so somebody like Christian was, and we've talked about it since. I interviewed him on Radio 4 about 3 months ago, and we had a really nice chat. He's a tricky character anyway, and he was the first to say that. But it was hard to hand over to him and his team, because they would come in with such swagger and such confidence, and I was just this pleb who'd just done 3 till 6:30 a.m. and perhaps done another episode of my feature Have I Got Poos for You, where I do an impression of a famous person taking a shit, and he would perhaps rightly be looking down his nose a little bit, thinking, well, I'm fucking interviewing Tom Hanks in about an hour's time, you prick, go and get me a cup of coffee, you know. So that dynamic was definitely very present, I remember many moons ago, way before that, when I first started my broadcast career at XFM, so the year 2000, and I was doing these midnight to 6 a.m. shows, the person who did the show before me was Ian Lee, who you may well know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A phenomenal broadcaster, who, very much like me, is sort of without portfolio now. It's like, we're too dangerous for UK radio. He's just brilliant. He's got like a really powerful cabal of people who love what he does, and quite rightly, because he's a bit of a genius. But it was a little bit Alan and Dave then as well, because I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. I literally probably had about 9 hours worth of broadcast experience, and he was handing the reins of this station over to me, and I'd come in and he'd call me Shawnee Diamond. Here he is, it's Shawnee Diamond. Shawnee, what have you got coming over us today? And I'd just be shiting myself, you know, like almost cross-eyed with panic.
Nothing really, you know, I've got a few.
Oh, and he'd sort of have a bit of banter and take the piss, and I'd be on the back foot, you know, and with my papers everywhere and shit. And that was the dynamic, you know. And so, yeah, that whole Dave Clifton combative thing, I definitely saw it happening, you know. Though I didn't really have the chops to fight back to either of those guys at the time, you know.
I think off the back of watching Alan and Dave like that, it pricked my ears up to listen out for it on air now. So I'm always very, what's the word? I like to scrutinise a handover.
Handovers are great. They're so great to spot the handover dynamic.
Because obviously you've got to give a certain amount of enthusiasm for the guest the next person's got on their show, but there's a way of pitching it that you can tell they don't think that's good. You know, they know that's not, they're telling you that's not good content.
Oh, I can't name, and I will not, there's no point going, oh, go on, you can't goad me. Name names, but there are definitely people that I know, you know, who are in the biz now who, they dread the handovers with certain people because of that dynamic, and because there's always somebody who they don't even know they're doing it, but they're making that other person feel a bit shit. Like, and I will throw into this conversation as a love letter to the person. Some of the handovers I used to love the most. I used to do a handover to Chris the Hawk Hawkins in the mornings, which I loved, and because he was dying on his ass by the time he's handing over to me. He was absolutely fucked and cross-eyed, but he. You know, we just have so much fun. And he'd always, we don't do this stupid thing called what did he call it now? The alphabet game. You start with A and you go down, you know, it's daft stuff. Or Marianne Hobbs, who used to hand over to me on the afternoons. We used to have so much warm, lovely fun. You know, it was the complete opposite of that. But you're right. There are some people, I must mention it, because I know both people. So it's not in a nasty way at all. It's just an observation. But, you know, it's like when they put Simon Mayo and Joe Wiley together for a while. It's like that was such a massive miscue by the management. Everybody's since realised that.
Infamously didn't gel, did it?
Yeah. And it's just such a shame for everybody involved. It's like, what the fuck are you doing? That's a stupid thing to do. These two great broadcasters, you don't put them together like that. That's like, you know, no. But... as a listener, it's fascinating to hear, isn't it? The dynamic fuck-up when two people don't belong together. It's like when me and Russell Brand did shows together, really. We used to do shows together. It was a bit like that. Bit awkward. Yeah. But that was mostly because Russell was high at the time, but also of prime Russell. Like, he was great, really.
Is there anything to drink in here, Sean?
Yeah, there's tea and coffee over there, and there's a water cooler over there.
No, I mean, is there anything to drink?
Well, it's 9 o'clock in the morning. What do you...
You mean anything to drink?
Well, there's an open bottle of white wine in the fridge. Oh, go and get them. Off he'd totter in his cowboy boots and he'd come back, you know. This is 2002, it was a long time ago. But, you know, again, it's the same thing as, like, bosses don't understand a lot of these things. They don't understand the tropical fish tank environment of a radio studio and how the introduction of one tiny thing can fuck everything up for the presenter. It could be an intern. Oh, you've got an intern working with you this morning. They're going to be sitting next to you and taking notes unsmilingly for 3 hours while you're trying to do stupid jokes. Anyway, it's like, well, you've just fucked my show up, basically, because you don't understand how sensitive I am and how sensitive I am to characters in the, you know, whether they get on with me or not, whether they understand the humour or not. So Alan and Dave, it's just poetry, isn't it?
I guess the interesting thing about that as well is the dynamic is a little different compared to some of the things you've talked about there, because with Alan and Dave, they're both kind of losers. Like, you know, Alan's got the graveyard shift. He's struggling to kind of get back on top, whereas he's always mocking Dave for being an alcoholic and just kind of, he's kind of like, he's a questionable character at the same time. So it's a different thing, but I think ultimately, exactly like Adam says, when you can hear those frosty handovers, that's always a very very entertaining listen.
I love it.
To chat from one spectrum of the Sean Keaveney career to the other, just a little bit about kind of working in comedy. Because you have dabbled in stand-up a bit over the years. Has that been and gone for you now? Would you ever see a return to that at all in any form?
Oh, it's funny, isn't it? Did I mute myself there? Am I back?
No, I'm muted. Yourself now.
You muted
no,
yourself
I've, now. I'm just yeah, doing right. it. See, that was funny in itself. That was a joke. I got into that by accident, completely by accident, and I suppose I've always been a fan of stand-up comedy. Like, you know, that's one of the ways in for me. It's a job that I've got. So when I did, to some degree, get of a bug. But unfortunately for me, I got the bug at exactly the same time. I was about to have a second child and was doing a breakfast show. So if you factor in the fact that I'm not the hardest working man in showbiz, in the sense that I'm not one of those people who are... There's some woman on Strictly at the moment who, she's very good actually, but I think she was in Dragon's Den or something, and they're making a film about her, you know, this is my week on Strictly. And it's like, up at 5:11, two work meetings, 6 o'clock, get the kids up ready for school, 7 o'clock, get the kids up for school, 20 past 7, 3 more meetings, 8 o'clock, into the Strictly studios for 19 hours of rehearsal. And I was like, you could fucking shoot me, because if that was my day on for more than twice in my life, you just put me down like a horse that's broke its leg. That's not how I want to fucking live, right? It's just not the way my brain works. So, you know, when I was trying to do stand-up, I was trying to... And then, just to be really Alan about it for a while, not long after that, my marriage collapsed. So you've got a breakfast show, two young kids, no marriage, and you're like the full ticket, you know. So struggled on for about 5 or 6 years, like trying to write stand-up comedy and perform it. And I did some pretty good gigs actually, and I used to do a gig every year at Glastonbury, and it was all quite fun, you know. Not the Pyramid Stage, I'll give you that, but you know, you eventually work out, especially after interviewing a lot of stand-up comedians and noticing with no irony their response to your comedy, your stand-up being like,
you're not a real comedian, mate. How many gigs did you do last month? Well, I didn't do any last month, actually. I did two the month before. You're not a stand-up there. Because, you know, it's like the Malcolm Gladwell thing. You've got to do 10... it's got to be your life, hasn't it? And you've got to do nothing but stand-up. You've got to eat it and shit it. And I did not do that.
Was comedy acting ever part of the mix as well? Or was it purely a stab at stand-up? Or were you sort of looking to do comedy in other areas as well besides radio?
In the end, I just wanted to do anything that amused me. And that I've suffered... Not suffered, he says, in his top room. You know, he's got a top room. He can't have suffered that bad. But, you know, I think the non-directional quality of what I do makes it difficult to you know. I'm a radio guy, basically, but I love making people laugh. I love making myself laugh, really. I love writing down stupid jokes. It's just like my dad. I get it all from my dad. My dad still sends me jokes all the time. You know, he's the guy who got me into it all. The wordplay and the dicking about. But yeah, I mean, about when I was still at 210 FM, Reading's Better Music Mix, there were these two guys called Scott and Mark who were like really funny comedy writers. And they were writing these like sort of half-hour comedies. And we would go into the studios and record them, you know. And I would act, in inverted commas, and really love that. Like a bit of Foley sound effect, a little bit of, you know, a bit of echo on the voice there as you pretend to be somebody working on a kiosk in a hotel, you know, delivering these funny lines that other people had written. I really loved that. So there was definitely a time where I thought maybe I could get into that a bit. But then I thought, oh, I can't remember lines and I'm not very good at acting, so that's out. And then me and my mate Steve wrote a shitload of... a comedy. We had this idea that we were going to write a sketch show, and I've still got a big trunk full of them. Some of them are quite good, and I got one of my sketches made, and I got £150 for it, and I've got it on VHS somewhere. It was in 2002 for the Karen Dunbar Show, which is a Scottish show. She's a legend of Scottish comedy, and she was basically a jazz singer who always looked like she was going to sing but then didn't sing and then walked off, and that was the end of the sketch. Not that funny when you say it out loud, but she did it well, you know. So then I thought, I'm going to move into that kind of comedy. I'm going to be like a sort of sketch writer, possibly a performer, and that was what writing radio ads was about. It was like every so often I'll get a funny one away and that'll be great. But in the end, it turned out that the best medium for me was playing songs on the radio and telling funny stories in between them, you know, because especially if you have a cartwheel with a load of sounds and stuff on it, you can actually weave these funny little worlds, you know. I was reminded just this morning by one of my old producers about how he had something pop up on his phone. It was on this day in 2013 on the breakfast show Six Music that we had to tragically kill off Dorothy the Dolphin. I'm not going to tell you any more about that, but you know, it was another little world that we wove, you know. And you don't need to get it past commissioners, and you don't need to have co-writers, and you don't need to have floor managers and seven cameras to do it. You can just do it like that and then play Wolf Mother.
Well, at the risk of being wanky, it feels like it's got almost a bit of a jazz element to it, in that it's relatively free form. You've got recurring motifs. You can, you know, you've got stuff that you're going to do every day. You've got stuff that you're going to pull out when you feel like it. So it sounds like there's an appealing freedom to it that you don't get from much else.
You're absolutely right. And everybody will tell you that. Anybody who's done a lot of radio and done a lot of television will say, fuck, get me back to radio, because you don't have the gatekeepers, you know. Well, you actually, it turns out you do, because sometimes the gatekeepers show you the gate and say, walk through it and don't walk back. And that's another story that I can't go into, partially because I don't understand it. But you know, you're right. While you've got the mic, there's nothing like it, I don't think. I was talking again to Nina Conti about it, because she was going through a lot of her... She's done so many pilots, and she was like, a lot of these were good ideas. I wonder why they didn't stick, you know. And we were both really genuinely postulating as to why we failed in television. And she just sort of went, I don't really like television that much, though. I'm not that into it. I'm more of a... I like comedy, I like live stuff, I like radio. And I was like, maybe that's what it is, you know. I mean, obviously, I love watching Alan, or I love watching Fawlty Towers, or I love watching comedy. I do love television, but I don't really want to be on it.
Yeah,
and I think like, that's the key I've worked out, is that I don't have a passion for myself for being on it. So that's probably what was missing, you know.
Yeah, I mean, to look again at sort of comedy and radio crossing paths in a different way. You've obviously spoken to Steve a few times on the show before, and Tim Key and other sort of people from the world of Partridge. Yeah. How was that? Did you get a bit of an insight into the making of Partridge, or was it a bit of a kind of, you know, they're in and out the revolving door of six music guests?
Yeah, well, I would say a bit of both. Like, oh, guys, you wouldn't believe how fucked up my brain is, and B, you know, like how bad my circuitry is. Like, to give you an example, just to lead into that, answering that question, one of my old interns, a lady called Emily, who's now a successful actor in her own right. So many people start on the Six Music Keaveney show and go on to great things. And she sent me a message a couple of years ago now. It was when Daniel Johnson had died. The great Daniel Johnson, who's a fantastic musician and beloved of everybody from Kurt Cobain to Michael Stipe, you know. Very influential man, had a lot of problems and stuff, obviously. And I don't know, I retweeted a thing about Daniel Johnson, sad he's died. And Emily sent me a direct message, and she said, I promise you this is relevant. And she said, I just want to say, Sean, you just reminded me, it was great to work on your show and stuff, and we had great times. I especially enjoyed the interview and session that you did with Daniel Johnson. And I had no recollection of doing it at all. Now, what that's about, I don't know. Whether people will play this interview back in 3 or 4 years' time after I've died of some terrible brain, you know, and they'll be like, oh, well, you did talk about that on the Monkey Tennis podcast. That's sad. But I had no recollection. I mean, because of how chaotic my life was, two young kids, breakfast show, no sleep, bit too much lager at times. Just don't fucking remember it. It's like, oh, yeah. We did a whole session and don't remember it. And it's a bit like that when you... I've talked to Steve a few times now, probably at least 2 or 3 times. I remember interviewing him once, nothing to do with Alan, when he was trying to get away from Alan. And he played some kind of rock star evil person in a big Hollywood movie. Can't remember which one it was now. Maybe a Terry Gilliam directed thing. Mm-hmm. And that was like, it's just like, I get to meet Steve, you know. And then I interviewed him a bit more recently. You know, and again, so little of it sticks to the walls. It's unbelievable, really. I remember being at Edinburgh Festival, and I was there with my producer, Paul Sheehan, at the time, who's the biggest, apart from being an idol, Idols, Flaming Lips, Steve Coogan. Those are his three idols. And it was very funny because we just watched something and Steve Coogan was in the audience, and we'd not long since interviewed Steve. Paul went off for a piss, and in that 4 minute window, Steve came over and we had a nice chat. You know, oh, how's it going? Yeah, not too bad. Yeah. Did you enjoy that? Yes, I'm here with my daughter. It's always great. Yeah, it's very funny. Yeah. It was Simon Amstel we were watching. And then, anyway, he walked off, and then Paul came back, and he was like, I said, I've just had a lovely chat with Steve Coogan, and he nearly topped himself. But Tim Key's a bit more of an actual mate of mine, I would say. And it was lovely to see him getting woven into that universe, because have you spoken to him on this? Have you?
Well, you have, yeah. We had a chat with him last year, I think.
He's got a legendary comic mind himself, and he's a fucking unbelievable actor as well. We watched him in Art. Mm. He was in the when they brought Art back to the West End a few years ago, and he's got, I can't remember, he's this big ranty monologue that he's in the middle of it, which a lot of actors are terrified of, because one misstep of this, it's like a sort of 7 minute rap, and he just utterly nailed it. And it's like, you've got a bit of a supernatural talent, Tim. But how much the fact that there's again, a bit like with Steve, there's so much of Tim's personality in Sidekick Simon. It's quite funny, yeah. You know. And I remember, I'm pretty sure that I saw Steve Coogan pretty much do that sort of, at some baby cow event at the when they were launching the Mighty Boosh in 2004, and I was there drinking some dry white wine. And I'm convinced I've got it embedded in my mind that I sort of saw Steve do that thing that Alan does, which is where he goes, I'm going to talk to somebody else now, and then walk away and talk to somebody else. I'm sure that happened in real fucking life. But
is it terribly rude if I stop talking to you and go and talk to somebody else? Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's so much of these people that are woven into their characters, but, you know, obviously most of the unpleasant stuff isn't in their real personalities.
All right. Well, look, we've got a few more things to wrestle through in terms of kind of like your thoughts on the Alan Partridge universe, as it were. But before we get to that, quickly, now I wonder, possibly this may be something that you won't remember based on the conversation we've just had. But Can we talk about the Alan Titchmarsh incident?
Did anybody else hear that?
I think for the benefit of the listeners, can you just regale us with this story?
Thanks for bringing this up, Tom.
Pleasure.
PTSD, I think, is the phrase. this reminds me. I'm Unreliable Memoirs, Clive James called his, and I think that's a good name for mine because it's like this is the way I remember it. But definitely around that time, around 2013 ish in my life, it was very. It was a bit murky. Young children, you know, sort of collapsed relationship. Probably having a bit too much of a good time. Getting up at 5 a.m. every morning to do this breakfast show. Not the most professional person all the time, to be honest. And the thing that's interesting about that, actually, even when my life wasn't like that, when you're doing 15 hours of live broadcast a week, that sounds like. You are 15 hours. So you are, I'll do 60 hours a week, don't pick. You know, that I come from the north, right? That I thought 15 hours a week, well, that's fuck all. But I've said this before, doing one live hour of radio is like cat years, you know. It's like three normal hours. And so it's a lot of hard work doing that much live radio, actually. And a lot of it was shit. Like, a lot of my shows weren't very good. You know, there was a time when, and the ratio would go up, you know, so sometimes it was like, I was getting like 9 out of 10 shows were good. But then other times it was like 7 out of 10. And then it may have gone down to like 6 at times. You know what I mean? I was like, oh my God. And around that, this time you're describing, I was doing some really poor shows. And I was just getting lost in... just tired and confused and not firing on all four cylinders. And when that happens, what you do start to notice is that everybody else starts to be infected by it. Your producer's got fear in his eyes. Matt Everett would come in. And I remember there were times with Matt where, because he'd be hearing some of the show, it would be going so badly that sometimes he would come in and sit down and he'd look me in the eye and he'd go, you all right? Like that real concerned mate thing. And I'd know then. Right, other people notice this is going badly as well. And the thing you're talking about, Tom, is one of these particular days, I remember it relatively well, we had Alan Titchmarsh in, and he was a live guest, and I, you know, did this bizarre interview with him where, you know, he was avuncular and pleasant. You know, I didn't get as much out of him as I would if I was interviewing him now. I fucking love it. Apart from the fact that my wife is a mad gardener. And also we've created a character, Evil Alan Titchmarsh. Oh, yeah? Think you're a gardener, do you? I'm about having a trowel around the back of your fucking head. You know, there's a lot more there now. But this time I was really on my uppers, really on my back foot, panicking a bit, getting things wrong, asking the wrong questions, being a bit of a shambles. And at the end of this... painful interview. I said, anyway, so, and the book is out now, isn't it, Alan?
Yeah, it's out now. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you very much, Alan Partridge. and he obviously thought that I was taking the piss, you know, which
yeah,
he would.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you know, you could tell he was rankled a bit, but I was like, no, you misunderstand. Alan Titchmarsh, I'm so sorry. And he sort of walked off feeling a bit aggrieved, and the listeners were like, he just called him Alan Partridge, you dickhead. And it was like just another one of my broadcast lows. There's loads of them.
I just thought that was worth Doing the research, being reminded of that, I thought it was worth recounting that.
Did that pop up somewhere on the internet?
It is on the internet. It is. I think it might be on your blog from those times. Yeah.
Jesus. Yeah. I probably wrote something at the end of the breakfast show or something.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's it. You just sign it off with fucking hell. You could have cut the air with the trowel, which I think is probably accurate.
I should put that in at Sean's bouncing back.
Definitely. Absolutely needs to be in there. All right, so back to our favourite Alan as we start to think about wrapping things up. I think a lot of the Partridge vehicles we've talked about have been his TV projects with you today. Is that kind of your fandom and viewership of Alan? You know, has it always revolved around the TV output? Have you ever been a fan of the radio output? Any thoughts on the films? Obviously, we've covered the books. We know you love the podcast. I guess, kind of, you know, what medium do you think Partridge suits best?
Exactly. I do like him on the telly. I do like... That is probably how I interface best with the character, yeah. I wasn't as immersed in Alpha Papa, you know, although I did enjoy it, and I probably should watch it again, because I did enjoy it. But I get too influenced by I should never read critical opinion, because it's like going back to the Beatles again. When I read Ian McDonald's Revolution in the Head, he managed to ruin about 11 Beatles songs for me just because he said a couple of, you know, like, oh, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds has got a bit of a boring chorus. And I'm like, fuck off, what? Since I was born, I thought it was one of my favourite songs of all time. But now you mention it, it is a little bit boring, actually. You know, a lot of people were sort of, there was a sort of received wisdom, wasn't there, that, you know, Alan's better with episodic television. It doesn't really stretch out very well to a film. You know, I think they say that about a lot of things that transfer from TV to film, don't they? The conceit's really great in small doses, but when you stretch it out, you can see the thinness of the pizza dough. And to an extent, I agree with that with the film. I thought it was, there's some brilliant moments in it, but that's it. It's a bit like when you watch a Simpsons movie. I always think I will watch it, and there'll be some great stuff in it. But get me back to the series.
Yeah.
With the radio stuff, we've had this discussion though. I will probably go back to listening to, like, would you be talking about things like On the Hour, like way back when?
Well,
would you recommend that I probably not listened
well,
to?
Well, I mean, I guess the most prominent thing is probably the original series of Knowing Me, Knowing You from Radio 4, because that's the first proper Alan-fronted vehicle that there was, which obviously was a direct continuation from the On the Hour shows, yeah.
That is, you know what, if I have listened to it, I probably haven't in 25 years or something, so I probably will go back to that. Like, it reminds me of those 210 FM days that... What I was obsessed with at the time, I was listening to the Fast Show on tape, you know. So it's era, isn't it? But
it was 1992. Was Knowing Me, Knowing You on so Radio before, 4. Yeah.
But that's it. Like that whole the day to day stuff, though. I just love that entry point, because I love all those other performers. You know, the influence of Armando. You know, Armando Iannucci and Peter Bainham and Chris Morris and all together and all the other the guys that worked on that, Rebecca Front and all those people working together. I love watching when Coogan's doing his stuff best, and the it just feels like everybody's performance goes up a notch, you know, like the giggling receptionist Sophie. What's her name now?
Sally Phillips.
Just a fucking genius, an absolute G. And the fella, I'm going to forget his name as well now, who's the young lad who's sort of flirts with her, who's, you know, I'll show you how to do the mirror trick if you want. You know, he's really loose, and he's really sort of sexy, and Alan's really jealous of him, even though, you know, it's brilliant. That whole thing about how anything can make him small, you know, but that era, I guess, is when I fell in the 90s. That's when I really fell in love with it. But I do love watching. I've luckily for me, I've got loads to catch up on this time. in particular. But I really, really enjoyed it. And his interface with the actor who plays, you know, the sort of the lady who he presents with is just...
Susanna Fielding.
She's so good. Yeah, you know, that whole thing. And Lolly as well, who plays the sort of the woman who, the reporter who's always contradicting him, and they have that. Yeah. That's genius. Just to set those things up. He always in opposition and but she sometimes he manages to get one back on her, and it's quite, and yeah. Again, you kind of root him for him as well.
It's funny you mention the Fast Show, because his bits with Ruth, with Lolly's character, always struck me as being a bit Fast Show-esque, in that it's one of the rare bits of Alan where it's quite a similar sketch each week, but there's just a minor note variation on it that makes it fresh.
Yeah. That's it, yeah. She's just contradicting him, and he sort of manages to get one back. But he always ends up kind of losing.
That's the thing, there's a really interesting parallel that's not really occurred to me before, which is some of the best comedy moments come from how other actors interact with Alan. So actually, you can kind of draw a line from Sally Phillips kind of being the giggling receptionist to Tim Key... like constantly looking scared and bewildered, or Susanna Fielding rolling her eyes. It's all about, I think, some of the best moments of Partridge are how others around him are reacting to him. That's where some of the best bits lie, I think. Oh, yeah,
absolutely. It's like, what I love is, you know, when it's just the vulnerability of him and the childlike nature of him. Like And the expressions, like sometimes he has this expression, like it's almost like a combination of disgust and fear when he doesn't understand something, or the bit that I'm trying to struggle towards is, I watched it again the other day, me old mate Simon Pegg, I forgot was in one. He's in the boat video one, isn't it? Young hip director. And is it Peter Bainham who plays the guy with the voice box?
Yep, it is,
that's right.
And that's just one of the best bits that illustrates his character the best, because, in 3 minutes or something, they get all this across, that he's trying to impress the young, sexy director, the young hotshot. He's trying to, glad hand the client and be like a big fish in a small pond. But at the same time, he's trying to be a sophisticate. He's trying to be a lad. Oh, lady boys, this is it. Yes, they're all my drinks, you know, and all that shit. Like, then we'll get down the pub and get rid of all these notes, you know. Oh, as well as all that, he's undercutting himself in this really childlike way, because he's never heard a guy...
It's because I've got no voice cards, Alan.
And all that. It sounds a little bit like a Star Wars character or something. And he's got no filter. He's like a fucking child. He's like one of my kids. He's like, you can't put him in a situation. He'll just say it. You know, if somebody's in a wheelchair, it's that whole Larry David thing, isn't it? It's like, oh my fucking God, what have you said that for? You know, but it's like, it's Alan. You know, everybody's just like, fucking hell. But what a multi-layered little few minutes that is. I just can't, it's amazing to watch it, I think. It's like, it's a masterclass.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah, to watch him sort of darting from one thing that he isn't to another thing that he isn't, like trying to keep all these plates spinning when he could just be himself and it would probably have worked out all right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, given that over the last 30 years he spanned radio, books, podcasts, TV, film, etc., what would you like to see Alan tackle next? Is it more of the same in any of those areas, or do you think there's a rich area for him to pick up that he hasn't yet? Obviously, we've got the arena tour coming next year as well. Strategy. Yeah, he's playing the O2, which I always think is funny, because it's really just Alan Partridge and Mrs. Brown's Boys that are British comedy at an O2 level, which feels very weird to me.
It's funny you should say that, because the lady who runs the O2 was a big fan of our show, and we went into quite deep talks about me playing the O2, and we're still talking about it. And we just, I was like, well, wouldn't it be funny though if I just rent the O2 out, but play it to 150 people and film that, you know? And he's like, well, you could do it. It costs you about 19 grand. It's like, it's an expensive joke. Like, yeah, okay, I'll think about that. I might crowdfund it.
Yeah, it's could you play it for 150 millionaires? There you go.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good idea. Maybe I've got a Maybe my demographic includes the Musks of this world. But yeah, I that's a good question. What would I want to see him do? Like, it's like what else, like you just pointed out, he's done nearly all the milieu, hasn't he? He's done nearly everything. He's not done a musical yet, as far as I know. Alan the musical, you'd probably have to weave it in with all the ABBA, all the new ABBA shit. Mm. But it's like when he dabbles these days in, when he, like I was saying before, in this time and stuff, and he's desperately trying to keep up with, you know, LGBTQ plus, you know, sort of stuff like that. It's so great to watch him struggle, because to some extent, the things that he's struggling with, culture wars or, you know, the sexual politics and things like that, most of us need information on these things, you know, especially as we get older. We all need to be educated. It's not a matter of being intolerant. It's like, I don't know these things. You need to teach me. And I think that's what's one of the great powers of Alan as he gets older, is that he speaks to a lot of us who are like, I'm a bit confused as well. I need help. You know, thank God he said something stupid and we can just watch and laugh, you know. But there's a real, again, there's such a deep well of truth in it that I'd love to see him do a wellness podcast or something, you know. I mean, he's probably already sort of done that, you know, but do more of that kind of thing where he's just blundering into territory that he has no idea about. It's a bit like me, really, again. Art imitates life, imitates art.
Well, that's actually, Sean, I think that's actually the perfect time to probably wrap up our Partridge Chat and give you a little moment to just tell our listeners about what you are working on at the moment. Seamless. Like, you queued that up perfectly for
us. I did.
I knew it was coming.
Oh, it's like, Ken Bruce, and you've got 30 seconds to tell everybody, to say hello to everybody you know. My current venture, the lineup, the podcast The Lineup, is doing quite well. It's basically like a fantasy festival podcast. It's just me interviewing various big names about, and I'm the festival genie, that wherever you get your podcasts. I'm really excited about my new thing coming out, probably new year now, which is Sean Keaveney's Creative Cul-de-Sac, which is more or less me talking through all my failed ideas in the top room, a bit like the Oast House but with less budget. And then we do that with a guest as well. We've had people like Samira Ahmed, Vic Reeves, some really great names have already done it. The aforementioned Nina Conti, loads of other people are up for doing it. We've got Bob Dylan and Michelle Obama coming up. You know, possible, you know, you'll see me popping up on stuff on Radio 4 and everything. I'm Without Portfolio on the radio. I'm always interested in offers, especially from Ocean FM. If there are any car dealers out there who let me have a Gullwing Tesla with my name on the side of it, I'm amenable to offers.
Well, if anything comes in, we'll send that your way. If we get any emails, yeah, that's fine.
Thank you very much. It's very kind of you guys. It's been a real pleasure, and thanks for asking me to do this. I'm sorry I've gone on so much.
It's been great. Thanks for coming on. We really, really appreciate it. We're here for the stories, getting an early take on the memoirs, basically.
Yeah.
It's a little preview.
Bouncing back, motherfuckers.
I mean, and speaking of projects on the go, presumably the royalties will start trickling back in from your 2016 Christmas song in the near future as well.
I'm glad you mentioned that. My mother said the other day when I last rang her up, "What are you're going to get your Christmas song back out and get that in the charts, aren't you?" I was like, "Fuck, I forgot I'd done one of those." Yeah, we got Rod Stewart on it, for crying out loud. Rod Stewart and Mark Kinger on that.
There you go.
You know what I mean? Matt Everett is on that.
Matt Everett.
Everett.
You can't win them all, can you?
So yes, watch out for that. Unfortunately, as a publisher told me when I tried to get money out of it, unfortunately, Sean, you've written a Christmas song that is basically the same title as one of the biggest Christmas songs of all time, Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You. So if you could change that, you might make some more money.
Oh, so, I would have thought you'd get a lot of royalties just for mistaken identity.
Oh yeah. Oh, they didn't think about that, did they?
Well, I'll tell you what, we can pop a link to it in the show notes, just to really start getting the streams up now. Beginning of November, it's about right.
The official start of Christmas. Yeah, more than Starbucks red cups.
That's it. My kids always take the piss because they look at it on Spotify and it's still got less than 1,000 listens. So
right, we're going to change that.
We can get it over 1,000.
That's a listener campaign. If everyone that listens to this podcast this week can also stream that track,
yeah,
let's see what happens. Yeah.
Yeah. All we want for Christmas is for you to listen to Please Don't Get Me Anything for Christmas by Sean Keaveney and Vince Meath.
That's it. He's got it. Thank you very much.
I am hopping mad and I want something in the middle.
Aha! Yep, absolutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dan!
Monkey tennis?
Little pierce my foot on the spine.
With a chuckle.
Monkey tennis?
Radical. Awesome. Mega.
Monkey tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Edmunds is a total wazzup of a guy.
Yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that?
Lad, this is great banter.
Yeah.
Back of the net.
Monkey tennis?
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.